Hello, everyone. We're going to try to make this fun because now I am competing with lunch. So we'll try to get into things pretty quickly. So before I get started, show of hands, how many folks here have been on call before? I see a couple. All right. So I myself have been an on-call practitioner for many years. And rather than sharing stories, I want you to just think about some of the worst on-call experiences that you have had, right? Think about times when you've been on the phone for hours or an incident extends endlessly or just it really has that soul-sucking quality to it. In my 20 years as a practitioner, I really dated myself there, in those 20 years, I can probably count on one hand how many times the incident itself was so bad that that's what was causing a problem as opposed to just having a process where there was no clear leader, nobody really driving to resolution, right? Conflicting ideas, and nobody really taking control of the situation. So I think bad process is part of the reason that on-call can really suck. And so I think as an industry, we can do better. And that's what I'm here to do. I think that sharing helps develop clear and effective incident response techniques. And so I think as an industry, what we need to do is we need to share the things that we are doing. We need to have some insight into how these things work in others, in the organizations of others, so that we can learn from each other and adopt good practices, refine them, and make them better, right? That's how we wrangle the chaos. That's how we get to a place where incident management is not quite as soul-sucking, right? Helps us avoid the burnout. So to do this, we need a little bit of transparency. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to share the details of an actual major incident as it occurred inside the walls of our company. Now, this is a largely unredacted, like 95% of a true story on stage. We changed some of the names so that we don't focus on particular vendors or particular technologies that aren't relevant to the incident as it played out. But everything else about this incident remains largely unchanged. So this is a true story. The events that occurred took place in San Francisco and in Toronto in January of 2017. But before I go into the story itself, I should tell you a little bit about myself and who I am and what we're going to talk about. So my name is George. I am a longtime infrastructure engineer. I'm the kind of person that gets paged when infrastructure or applications go down. Majority of my career was in what's now defined as an SRE role. I'm also pretty outdoorsy. I like to travel. I love to snowboard. I love being out in the backcountry where anything can happen, right? So emergency preparedness is kind of important for things like that. I've done a lot of work with Cal Fire. I grew up in Southern California, and that inspired me to become an EMT and a first responder. So emergency response systems are very important to me. I am part of the fire arts safety team at the annual Burning Man Festival, which means that what I do is I take time off to go put myself in emergency situations where things are literally burning around me, right? This is what I do for fun. So incident response systems, the ways that we deal with crisis really matter to me. I'm really passionate about these things. So now I work at PagerDuty. Is anybody familiar with PagerDuty? Raise your hands. A couple folks, right? So if you don't know PagerDuty, we are one of the companies that will wake you up when things go wrong, right? We do incident alerting, and so dealing with incidents when they happen, right, that's our bread and butter. So there's a big Venn diagram of interests there between PagerDuty and myself and my background. So here's what we're going to do, right? We're going to learn via transparency. I also want to say this is the first time that PagerDuty is sharing data like this publicly about an incident as it happened inside of our walls, largely unredacted. I also want to make it clear that this is not a vendor talk. This is about PagerDuty the company and not PagerDuty the product. And in fact, when things go wrong with our platform, we can't use PagerDuty to fix it because PagerDuty is what's broken, right? So everything that I talk about today is the process that we use to manage incidents, and we're going to see that play out with an actual major incident that occurred. Also, I want to say that a lot of the process that I'm going to talk about today is based on the incident command system. Any folks familiar with the incident command system? I see at least two hands. Cool. So for those that aren't familiar, the incident command system comes from CAL FIRE and large-scale fire disasters, where you have a number of fire battalions all responding to the same big problem and emergency. And it turns out the different fire departments work in different ways. They have different tool sets, different ways of communicating. And when you need to coordinate a large response, you need a common framework. It's a similar way that you can all talk to each other and work together towards resolution. It turns out that's what a lot of enterprise software teams are like, right? Different software teams own different parts of the stack. They have their own tooling. They have their own languages they write in. They have their own ways of working. But when things go wrong and you have major disasters with your web applications, the same thing applies. We need a common framework to figure out how we work together. So it turns out ICS is very applicable to this kind of system. All right, I'm going to give you a little bit of background before we get into the incident itself so you can understand what it is that went wrong and how these components come together. So there are a couple of services we're going to be dealing with. There is a DB to Kafka service. I'll talk about what that does and what it migrates. And there's also an incident log entry service. The thing that you need to know about these two services is that they are both containerized, right? They're running via Docker containers. And at the time when this incident occurred, we were using Marathon to manage all of our containerized instances, at least for these services. Those Marathon instances were running on top of Linux machines. And so that's the stack and the way that it came together. The thing that you need to know about these services is that the DB to Kafka service took things from our web monolith. At the time, it was a web monolith. We've done some talks around how we've turned that into modern microservices. But at the time, we had this really big web monolith that had events that other processes needed to consume. So we would take it out of that monolith, put it into Kafka, and other services could consume that. The incident log entry service was one of those consumers. And so the incident log entry service, whenever you get paged by PagerDuty and we tell you there's a problem, you can click in a little bit to see what are some of the details around this alert, right? What error conditions really set this off, and you can dig in and get quite a bit of info around what we think is wrong. So those are the components. That's what you need to know, right? We had some problems with DB to Kafka and with this related incident log entry service. Let's talk about some of the people that respond. So we're going to look at this incident via a chat log. And so there are a number of folks you'll see responding on the screen. One, there is a set of major incident responders whose job it is to manage the incident, right? They are not subject matter experts. What they do in the incident is take charge of the situation, make sure that we're working towards resolution, and make sure that we do things that will help us learn from this incident and make it better in the future, right? So we have a set of responders. We'll talk about what those folks do. In this incident, we also have a number of subject matter experts. And so I won't go into what all of the teams do, but basically the core team is the team that creates shared infrastructure services like Mesos that other teams can use. There's an incident management pipeline service, the IAM teams, right? And so they do the notification pipeline. They manage that incident log entry service, reporting, analytics, right? Any type of alerting around events that you need to know about. EM is event ingestion, so processing events, turning those into alerts and incidents, et cetera. And then we also had somebody responding from a mobile team. So if you don't know this, PagerDuty, because you want to know when things go wrong, has a mobile app. So when you get an alert, it can show up on your phone. And so we have a mobile team that manages that. So let's get into the details of the incident and the way that the incident went down. So, like I said, we're going to see this via the way a chat log played out. And so we'll see that we start. We have David, one of our SMEs, run a command called icpage inside of a chat room. This is a Slack integration that we've set up so that anyone at any time can trigger a major incident and say, I need help. This is a big thing. Let's get folks on the line. So that command goes ahead and triggers our chatbot. Our chatbot pages the folks that are currently in a responder rotation, right? They page Eric, Ken, and Peter. They start an incident that we will use to track all of this. And then David tells us in this chat room, hey, DB to Kafka is down, and I'm not really sure what's going on. So Eric, one of the folks that was paged, takes the incident commander role, and he was the primary on-call to fill a role like this. So let's talk about what an incident commander does. So an incident commander is more or less the wartime general. I'm not in love with this analogy, but the analogy works, so stick with me for a minute. So this person is the decision maker during a major incident. Their goal is to drive the incident to resolution quickly and effectively. And they do that by doing a couple of things. One, they gather data, right? They ask subject matter experts to tell them what's going on, right? Diagnose, debug the systems. You know, they are not a subject matter expert, but they rely on what their subject matter experts have to tell them. And then an incident commander's main job is to listen, right? You're telling me about the emergency scenario and the things that you see. I need to gather all of that, make sure that it's understood, and then decide on a course of action. The main job of an incident commander is to have a proclivity to action, right? We've discovered things about the system. Now we need to act. And even if we make the wrong decision, making the wrong decision is better than making no decision, right? Even if we make the wrong decision, we have bad inputs in the system, we get bad outputs, we understand a little bit more about the scenario and what's not going to work, and we understand more than we did had we taken no action at all, right? So listen to your subject matter experts, figure out a course of action, and then act, right? And this is where the general analogy makes sense. An incident commander delegates those actions, right? They are not doing the work of resolving the incident themselves, right? They delegate that to somebody else on their team. So back to our incident, right? Ken, who was also paged, was part of that IC rotation, joins, and he takes the role of deputy. We'll talk about that deputy role in a second. Ken, realizing that the DB to Kafka service is down, realizes, hey, you know, Renee is probably going to be needed on this call, so pages her via chat. And we have a couple of other responders join in, right, from SRE and from event management to tell us that they're there. Let's talk about Ken's role for a minute, right? So the deputy is basically a backup incident commander. You can think of a deputy as a sidekick, right? They're the right-hand person for this incident commander, and their job is to do a couple of things. One, they monitor the status of the incident. They make sure that everyone knows what's going on, that we're not dropping anything in the process, right? They keep tabs on what's happening. They do things like follow up on time box tasks, right? I tell you that, or you tell me that you need to reboot a server. I ask you how long it's going to take. You say 5 minutes. Great. In 5 minutes, I'll come back and check on that. Deputy just makes sure that things like that actually happen. And the deputy might do things like page other folks, get the right responders on the line, right? And do some of the work of making sure we have the right people on the right incident or on the incident at the right time. Mainly, though, their job is to make sure that they keep the incident commander focused on the incident and not distracted by having to do a bunch of work that they can handle, right? Keep the IC focused on resolving the incident. All right, so back to our incident. We see that what starts happening in our chat channel is that Ken starts scribing what is happening. So whenever we have an incident, right, whenever someone triggers the alarm, there are two communication channels. There's a chat channel, which is what we're seeing, and then there's an incident call bridge, right, that folks are expected to join, and most real-time discussion happens on that call bridge. What the chat channel is for, the chat channel is there to act as a source of record for what happened, what decisions were made, what did we discover. If we need to look at the text of a command or something that's being proposed, the chat channel is there. Part of the reason that the chat channel is helpful is if you have responders join the call later, you can look back at the chat channel to figure out everything that was talked about, right? It's like a real-time log of what's happening. So what Ken is doing here is he is transcribing who said what at which time, right? So Eric, our IC, is asking what we've looked at, right? We've looked at logs, seeing some errors, tried restarting, and it doesn't help. We have a subject matter expert, our responder from the mobile team, tell us that they start seeing crashes in our Android app that are triggered by looking at incident log entries. One of our other responders tells us that no incident log entries can be generated because that service relies on DB to Kafka, and we know that that's what's having issues. And further, right, one of our other subject matter experts starts talking about notifications going out, right? We still tell you that something is wrong, but when you click in, you've got blank details. You can't really figure out the depth of what's happening with your infrastructure. So they're discussing some of the visible customer impact. Then what we see is, what is this, about 6 minutes after the incident started, Peter, who is also Paige, joins and says, all right, I'm here now. Ken, right, you can go on being deputy. I will go ahead and scribe and keep tabs of what's happening and put those things into the chat channel. And he does that, right? We note that we're doing a couple of things. We're trying to find somebody that's pretty familiar with Mesos because it looks like something's wrong with Mesos. And we're starting to look at logs and dashboards to figure out what's wrong. Let's talk about that scribe role for a minute, since somebody came to take over that. A scribe is basically a record keeper, right? They are not a stenographer. The idea is what they are doing is they add notes to the chat room when findings are determined or when significant actions are taken, right? Their whole job is to help try to reconstruct a timeline when you look back on this event to try to figure out what happened. They also do things like add to-dos, right? If we determine that there's a problem, right, I needed this particular bit of documentation, it did not exist, the scribe will go ahead and put in a to-do item. Once this incident is over, we should go back and we should fix that problem. But mainly what the scribe is trying to do is generate notes that are going to be helpful in reconstructing this timeline of events and that are particularly helpful in the postmortem. So going back to what's happening, right? Our incident commander is trying to assess customer impact. We see our subject matter experts talk about what the incident impact is. And our incident commander then asks, okay, well, obviously this is affecting our customers, right? They can't create incident log entries or they can't view them. They're seeing errors in the web UI when they try to look at these things, so obviously there's a visible customer impact. So our incident commander asked, hey, is there a comms person on the line? And there is. We've discovered that that's Luke. So our incident commander asks Luke to please go ahead and compose a message to our customers. And Luke goes ahead and writes a message. So he says, all right, this is, I think, what I'm going to say to customers, right? There's currently an issue affecting the incident log entries component, causing the application to display errors, and we are actively investigating. What happens at this point in the call is our incident commander asks everyone to please read the message and see if there are any strong objections to posting this, right? Does this seem correct? This is your chance to tell us. And seeing that there are no objections, Luke says, go ahead, please post that to our status page and to Twitter. So this is the point where you would see a degraded service notification come from PagerDuty, and when you get these messages, right, that is how these are generated and how they come about. Let's talk about the communications liaison and the person that generates those messages and puts them out to customers. So a communications liaison is basically your link to the customer. Their job is to monitor customer impact and business impact. And so at PagerDuty, the way that we usually do it is one of the members of our support team fills this role because they can see incoming support requests, right? They will be able to very quickly gauge what sort of customer impact we're having based on who's telling us that they see a problem with our application. They also then provide regular updates to customers, and they should provide regular updates to business stakeholders. So just as we communicated with our customers via status page and via Twitter, we need to communicate with internal stakeholders to tell them what's happening with our application. One of the things where this is, you know, 95% of a true story, we omitted some things for brevity. So what we don't see is some of the internal stakeholder communication in this incident, but that also occurs following the same method. So going back to our incident, Now we see David has added a measles expert who is not on call, right? We needed to figure out what was happening with measles. Something looks like it's wrong. Nobody on the call knows what to do. Great, let's find somebody else that can answer that question. Our incident commander asks, hey, is there a runbook for measles? And the response is, well, yes, but not for this broken state. So our scribe notes that down, right? We need to create a runbook entry that tells us how to restop Marathon and restart everything from scratch because nobody on this call knows how to do that. A few minutes later, and you'll note the difference in timestamp entries here, our Mesos expert who was not on call responds and says, hey, I don't have a laptop. I just showed up at a pub for dinner. Like, what's going on? So we ask him to go ahead and please join the conference bridge because we have a couple of questions. We have a recording of this call that we've also shared, and you can hear how this back and forth actually sounds. What our Mesos subject matter expert needs to do is he actually needs to go find someplace quiet in this pub where he can have a conversation, but it takes him a couple of minutes to join the call. And so now we see, right, as this continues to evolve as an incident, we start figuring out, well, what are some of our contingency plans and what's actually happening. So what we start seeing is that we have a number of Mesos replicas which are going offline, right? Replica 2 is not reachable, replica 3 is not, replica 1 is still there, but we're looking at a Mesos cluster that only has 3 replicas, right? So we're on the edge of just losing that cluster entirely. So we start trying to figure out, well, should we migrate, right? What's happening? Still don't know. One of our SREs sees that there are some memory exhaustion issues going on, but no clear idea what's happening yet. So we start looking at options, right? Well, you know, we could migrate to another region, or we could still hold tight and try to restart Marathon. So our incident commander is listening to his subject matter experts and recapping, right? Okay, these seem to be the two options. We need to make a decision. Right at that same time, our SRE discovers an issue that the killer has kicked on replica 1, right? So the Linux out-of-memory manager has gone ahead and killed our Docker containers as they're trying to start. Hearing that, our Mesos expert says, go ahead, try restarting Marathon first, right? Restart those replicas and let's see what happens. So great. Our incident commander goes with that, right? Seeks strong objections. Nobody has any. So we ask Evan to go ahead and reboot replicas 2 and 3. Evan tells us, all right, replica 1 is now down. I went to reboot those others, and I lost the third one. So that cluster is effectively gone. So we start trying to figure out contingencies, right? Hey, can we bring up another cluster? Our subject matter experts start discussing, and they figure out, well, yep, we can go to another region pretty quickly if we need to do that. But in the meantime, while we're trying to figure out how we would mobilize that response, right, we decide that what we're going to do is stop all of the replicas in that region, not migrate yet, try to start all the replicas first, and see if that fixes the issue. Evan tells us that replica 2 came back online. He gives it a couple minutes to make sure that it's stable and it's quiet. We can restart things. Replica 2 comes back as well. And when replica 2 comes back, he tries to start our Docker containers, but the Docker containers exit with exit code 137. What the hell is exit code 137, right? Somebody needs to go figure that out. In the meantime, replica 3 also comes back. And then finally, we discover that exit code 137 means that the Docker container is still being terminated by the killer. So the killer is just sitting there killing containers over and over and over again. So we come up with a couple of proposed actions, right? We suggest, well, first, we're running out of memory, so let's give those containers a little bit more memory. And we're also going to force reboot replica 01. If you recall, replica 01 also stopped responding, but the other two, replicas 2 and 3, finally came back online. In the meantime, we're trying to figure out, okay, we're having this disaster with our infrastructure. What's the customer impact? Luckily, the customer impact still looks pretty low. our customer liaison tells us there are 4 tickets so far, 2 customers chatting with us, right? So probably a total of 6 tickets, people that have actually noticed that this is a problem. So we keep digging a little bit further, right, and discover, all right, well, now that those containers came back up, or those replicas came back up, the DB to Kafka service appears to be running, and it looks like everything else is running, right? Making that change to modify memory seems to have worked. Once those containers came back up, we had a backlog of notifications that needed to be processed, and we start seeing that the log entry service is now picking those up, processing them, and it looks like we are actually starting to recover. So let me summarize this incident and what ended up happening, right? So we had a number of contributing factors. One, there was an increase in traffic that we noticed through some of our dashboards that caused the DB to Kafka instance to just balloon in size when it comes to memory. That caused the Linux killer to start killing the process, right? Out of memory, terminate process, problem fixed. But because these are all being managed by Marathon, right? Marathon keeps restarting the container, keeps reballooning, killer goes in, kills it, right? And we just get this constant loop of things coming up and dying. Turns out that was complicated because there was a Linux kernel bug that created a race condition after that restart kill cycle went a couple of times, which is why we also started to unexpectedly just lose hosts out of the blue and they would stop working. And because, of course, right, if you start losing those Mesos replicas, you're going to start affecting other services, right? The log entry service was affected by that outage, and it itself also went offline temporarily. So again, notice that in that scenario, right, we had a number of responder roles who were taking stock of what was happening, were investigating alternatives, right, making decisions about what needed to go forward, and giving our SMEs the space to go investigate what's happening on the system, dig around, looking for clues, do their work, but also make sure that we're recording what happens, recording which decisions are made when, and giving folks the proper space to get things done. So that was the incident itself, right? But there are some other impacts that I think are equally meaningful that come out of this. Let's talk about postmortems. So at PagerDuty, the postmortem process that we have works something like this. Once the incident has been closed and the incident is no longer affecting our applications or our infrastructure, we then pick an owner for the postmortem process. In this case, our owner was David, right? He was the first responder to the core team that responded to the incident and escalated it to a major issue, right? He's the first person that we saw in that chat log. So he becomes the default owner of creating a postmortem report. So that postmortem report is owned by one person, so it's very clear who needs to generate that and who is responsible for delivering it. However, that person can pull in as many folks as needed. And it turns out with this many moving pieces, it took quite a bit of investigation to figure out what was actually happening and what systems were affected. Then you need to schedule a postmortem meeting as the owner of it. And I gotta tell you, this is actually the hardest part of running a postmortem, right? Just trying to figure out when all of those schedules align so we can talk about what happened. This incident happened on January 6th. The postmortem meeting was scheduled for January 11th. We usually recommend having a pretty fast turnaround there so you don't lose sight of the things that you just learned, right? So usually have an SLA of about 3 to 5 days to make sure that that meeting happens and everything is published. And then as the owner, it is your responsibility to create a draft of the postmortem report. We'll talk about what is in that report in a second. And then you conduct the postmortem meeting, right? So let's talk about what we do in that meeting, right? The point of that meeting is to go through the report and finalize it based on the discussions that we have while this meeting occurs. So the postmortem report should have a few things in it, right? One, just the facts. Here's a description of what happened, plus a timeline. This is when everything that the scribe captured really comes into play, right? Because you can very easily look back and try to figure out what decisions were made, who went out and created certain actions, right? And again, it's not a stenographer role, right? Any decent conference bridge these days can get you a text output of everything that was said on the call. But what you are looking for is just what were those important markers, those important events that we need to care about, right? Use that to reconstruct a timeline of everything that occurred. What was the customer and the business impact, right? So what was the severity of this incident, right? We understand what was happening internally, but externally, what was the magnitude of this thing? And then contributing factors, right? I have root cause up there, and I have mixed feelings about root cause. It's never a particular root cause or one thing that causes an incident to occur, right? It's usually a number of contributing factors. Even if there's just one trigger and one thing that actually kicked off this incident, what were the conditions that allowed that trigger to exist, right? What were all of the things that made it possible for this incident to occur the way that it occurred, right? List out those contributing factors to understand why this incident was able to proceed as it did. And then what actions did we take that actually resolved the incident, right? Not what's wrong, but what did we do that got us back into a working state, right? So just start with the facts. And in the postmortem meeting, we're going to talk about a couple of things, right? What went well, what didn't go so well, once we review all of the facts, and then we're going to figure out what action items can we take to mitigate some of these things so that we don't encounter the same issues, hopefully again, in the future. So that first four set, right, like just those facts, those are the components that whoever owns your postmortem needs to get down, right? Everything that happened, what impact it had, why we think it was able to occur, and what we did to fix it, right? So that then, in our postmortem meeting, we can review that, make sure that we all understand and all agree this is what happened, and given those facts, then we can talk about what went well, what didn't go well, and what we need to do in the future. So for us, our timeline ended up looking like this on the event. And we'll see a couple of things here that we discovered. One, we had a time to detect of about 7 minutes. So in UTC at 2250, right, we first saw that spike in requests that caused DB to Kafka to balloon in size. The killer, about 26 seconds later, finally started at that point to terminate containers. But we did not actually get anybody paged to look at that until about 7 minutes later, right? So it's kind of a bit of a long time to detect that there was an issue going on. Once we did detect an issue that was going on, right, the time to acknowledge was really fast. David was on it right away, right? He acknowledged that incident, started to look at it, and we can see that a couple of minutes later, he actually started escalating to other folks on the core team because he didn't know what was wrong and he needed some help. And then we see that about a good half hour after, 35 minutes after the incident first started, that is when we escalated to a major incident status, right? So this incident had been going on for well over half an hour before we saw that chat log start, before we saw, hey, I need help, this is more than I can handle. And then once that started, we see that, all right, well, when we actually sent out that tweet that we were investigating the issue, that wasn't too far after, right? That was about 9 minutes from the time we were aware that this was a very big issue, but that was in reality probably about 40 minutes since this thing started. And then there are a bunch of things that, you know, we trimmed out here, but when we look towards the end of the timeline, we see a couple of other meaningful things as well. We can figure out when the issue was diagnosed, right, at 2349, and about 4 minutes later, we started taking some remedial actions, right? We changed our memory allocation settings, we rebooted those instances, we tried to restart the containers, and then within a few minutes, we started recovering, right? DB to Kafka was running, we started processing the log, and then we see that once the replicas are back up and the backlog is cleared at 5 minutes after midnight, once the entire backlog is cleared and we can confirm that this issue is no longer happening, 5 minutes later, we posted the tweet saying this issue is resolved. And about a minute after that, we spun down the incident call and everything was closed. So understanding the incident, right, means that we need a couple of things. So going into the postmortem meeting, right, this is what David created. There is a very long narrative of what happened, right? What were the contributing factors, right? What did we see? How did we resolve it? The contributing factors were listed as an increase in traffic, possibly in getting larger records. We weren't sure at the time what it was that actually created that memory balloon of the DB to Kafka service, but there was an increase and it increased its memory usage. That was exacerbated by the Linux kernel bug that caused Mesos to keep killing those containers or starting them, right? And the killer would kill them, and those Mesos slaves then froze up and this cascading error got worse. And the resolution, right, was pretty straightforward. The temporary thing that we did was we changed the C group memory limit from 512 megs to 2 gigs, which is kind of ridiculous. But hey, it was an emergency scenario, right? We needed to work around it, throw a bunch of memory at it, restart it, everything came back up, and now we can figure out what happened. So this is everything that we had coming into the postmortem meeting, right? No clear set yet on exactly what had occurred. Or sorry, we had a very clear picture of what had occurred, but not a clear picture of what was going to be done to remediate it in the future, right? Again, coming in with just the facts, here's what we know, here's what happened. The incident impact, I won't spend a bunch of time here, but if you listen to the recorded call that we have for this, you'll hear at some point that the team actually thinks the impact is bigger than it is, and they escalate the incident to severity one, which is the worst type of incident that we can have. Going back later and looking at the actual incident as it was measured, the team discovered that it actually did not meet the threshold for what we defined as a sev one. So we had actually just spent that entire incident as a severity two. We didn't have any notifications that were delivered outside of our SLA agreements publicly. What we did see was that some customers experienced 500 errors on the web UI when they would click in to get details, right? They would get, not details, they would just get this horrible page. And on the Android app, customers that were trying to drill into incident details actually had their apps crash on them. So getting an error for those incident log entries was actually a pretty harsh experience. But it was only a pretty harsh experience for about 1% of our customers. So here's what happened in the postmortem meeting itself. One, you go through the timeline as a team, right? Here are the facts as I assembled them. Do you agree, right? Is this your perception of the incident as well? So ensure everyone agrees that the timeline is accurate, that it's comprehensive, that it captures all of the moving bits of what we saw in the incident itself from a very objective standpoint. And then once we're clear on that, once we all agree, yes, this is the incident as it occurred, then talk about, you know, what the group has learned going through the timeline. And so we recommend doing that in a brainstorming format after you've covered this timeline, right? And it usually might take you a little bit of time to go through. What ideas do you have for what we have learned, what could go better? And there are several formats for this. I actually have some resources if you want some like very clear prescriptive ways to do that. I'm a big fan of sticky notes. I also work remotely, so I'm a big fan of things like stickies.io or Trello cards, right? Just some way that you can very quickly get those things out. Everybody can see the ideas and you can kind of sort them and figure out, you know, what themes that are there, right? What common things we've seen, and start pulling those into some sort of digestible format. And now that we've talked about learnings and things that we've discovered throughout the course of the incident, then we can talk about what went well, right? Celebrate the things that you did well and the little wins that you had, and also talk about the things that did not go so well, right? What could we have done better? What was a bit of a gap? You should capture all of those things and put those in the postmortem report after you've had a chance to discuss. And then finally, right, we create a list of action items. Given the things that went well and the things that did not go well, what do we need to do to improve in the future? So for this incident, here's how it went down, right? Things that went well. We had some folks on the core team that were not on call just jump into the incident channel and help make the incident better. That was amazing. The SREs that were on call were very helpful in terms of identifying issues, going into infrastructure, restarting boxes. And overall, for this event, our notifications still went out, so our customers knew they had a problem. They just couldn't get very detailed bodies, very detailed descriptions of what was happening if they received a notification in this time window. Things that did not go so well, the core person on the team that was the primary on call did not know when to escalate this issue into a severity to or a major incident. Right? As we looked at the timeline, that incident had been going on for well over half an hour before they pulled the alarm and said, this is a big thing that is really affecting us and we need to know. We need a bigger response, right? And part of that was the fact that there was just not a very explicit SLA around the expectations for that service. That failing DB to Kafka service also caused cascading failures in other Mesos-hosted applications, right? We started to lose one specific service. That one was being killed over and over again. But because of that Linux bug, we started to lose replicas, which meant any other host that was on that Mesos cluster started to get hosed too. And then one of the other things that we identified as not going so well is when you did see an error, right, you got either that 500 error on the web UI or your Android app crashed, right? That is not a very graceful failure handling situation when we have degraded services, right? So we should probably fix that. We should make that less jarring if we are missing some data. So this is what our action items ended up looking like, right? Make sure that the Android app doesn't crash if there's no incident log entry. Great. We had that created. That was assigned. We tracked that item and made sure that it was done, right? And you can see some of the other things that we decided to do. One of the things that I'll point out is towards the bottom, right, we see upgrading the Mesos slave boxes to a higher kernel. That was assigned, and that actually ended up becoming a won't-do item. We had an infrastructure limitation from our infrastructure service provider that did not allow us to make that change. So we identified it as an action item, but we decided, hey, we're just not going to do it and work around it instead. But the point here is that all of those action items should be tracked, right, should be clearly assigned, and there should be some level of accountability to make sure those things are done. And then this is my favorite part, right? The public postmortem. So if you want to take a look at this incident and the things that we shared, PagerDuty publishes all of our postmortems publicly for anyone to read. And so here is a summary of what we saw happen, right? What the impact was and what we're doing about this in the future. So the public postmortem is not as detailed as some of the things that I shared, right? And you'll see this is a very sanitized list of what we think went wrong, right? What we're going to do in the future. But the thing that I want to stress is that we do not consider an incident closed until that postmortem is published, right? So the postmortem process is just as important as dealing with the incident and getting it resolved, right? This is part of the incident lifecycle. So that incident is not officially closed until a postmortem is published and completed. So that's it, right? As practitioners, I believe that one of the things that we can do to help make these practices better is be transparent about what these incidents look like when they occur behind our walls. And I think this is the first step to showing you how we do things and hopefully getting you to think about what your processes are like and think about sharing those in return as well. I think that sharing allows us to improve our processes. I'm a big fan of the incident command system. I think there are some really good resources on the next slide for looking at how that practice works, how you can manage different teams working in different ways in some common way to drive toward resolution. I also believe that publishing a postmortem, right, is absolutely critical and a part of the process. If you are not doing today, absolutely needs to be done, right? That is every bit as important as making sure that your services are back up. Understand what happened, create those action items, make sure that learnings are reintroduced back in your organizations. And then most importantly of all, right, I think that we can do this in open sourcey ways that help develop your plan or that hopefully start contributing towards the plans of others. So I have a couple of resources here at the end. So the incident command system, if you can see that, response.pagerduty.com is a very detailed list of what that incident management process is like. I would say it's probably about 90% of what we do internally at PagerDuty. There have been a number of contributions to it from other folks in our community, from customers, from other folks that are as passionate about incident response as well. So it's not 100% what we do, but you can see how it's evolved over time and these practices continue to be iterated. So that documentation, again, is available for you completely free and open. You can fork it, you can make contributions to it, but it's a great place to start. There's a guide for blameless postmortems. I didn't really talk about the blameless side of postmortems, but if you want to get into it, find me afterwards and we can talk about ways to build that. Or this guide is a really good step-by-step way to run a postmortem. It runs you through the types of language that you use, the types of questions that you ask, and helps you build postmortems in a way that don't feel like they are pointing fingers. We didn't talk about stakeholder communications at all. We kind of glossed over it, right? It's one of the things that our communications liaison was doing. But we have a really good guide around how to communicate to your stakeholders internally, how to set expectations, what those time frames are like, the kinds of things that you should say. And then that simulated incident call that was based on this incident, right? That is, we basically did a reenactment of the incident as it went down and recorded it so that you can see it, hopefully between that, this presentation, and the postmortem that's shared, you can get an idea of how these things work end to end. And so my invitation to you is, having been this transparent with how incidents work behind the walls of PagerDuty, I hope you will take a look at these resources. Maybe use them to start creating your own incident response plans inside your organization. But if they work for you, reach out, let us know how they went, and hopefully you'll become a part of the incident response community. So that's that. I think we have time for questions. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, how do you get people to follow processes the right way, right? And is there some sort of QA mechanism to make sure that you are adhering to those things in a way that is helpful? So what I would say to that is, yes, absolutely. So when you create an incident response plan, it's sort of like dealing with backups, right? You don't know if your backups are good unless you restore them. And like the earlier talk that was in this room, right? If you're restoring them very often, then you know that they actually work. It's the same thing with this process. So once you create a plan, it's very important to actually practice that plan and make sure that folks understand their role and understand if they are meeting the process as described. Also, one of the things that you'll discover is that your process itself may start out with things that we describe in those documents. But that may not work for your organization, and so you need to iterate that as well. So one of the things that you can do, and one of the things that we do at PagerDuty is we set up what we call Failure Friday scenarios, right? And so we have a particular bit of our infrastructure that we are going to break in a particular way where maybe we don't understand all of the failure modes, but we kind of think we know what's going to be there, and we run it as an actual incident. And those Failure Friday scenarios are a good place where, like, up-and-coming incident commanders that maybe kind of understand the process but haven't done it in the heat of the moment will step up and try out the process, right? They'll try to follow the rules, get a chance to practice it in a controlled way, and then once that scenario is over, we run a postmortem on it, right? And we do it again. And so that postmortem is a chance to get feedback not just on how the incident itself went, but what people's responses were like, right? And it's a chance to provide feedback so that you know, one, how you're performing according to the process, and two, so that you know if the process itself is even working. Any other questions? Can I go back to the last slide? That is a good question. I see the last slide. There we go. Yeah. So the question was, it's like the incident command system and that process and having those responder roles, that all looks great, but how do you actually make that happen, right? Does that have to happen from the top down, or trying to make that happen from the bottom up is not always successful? Here's what I find. Big changes in process, oftentimes the reality of it is they're born out of a lot of pain. Right? And so if your current incident management process is not working, that's when I see folks make top-down moves to adopt something like this, right? Just because you realize the process is not working. I think it can work bottom-up as well. This particular incident, because of the way it was structured, was pretty major. It involved a number of teams, and so it was pretty heavyweight, right? We had those four folks in those, you know, separate administrative roles managing things. If you're on a team of six people, right, that's a little heavyweight, right? And it's not really going to happen. The incident command system scales up and it scales down. And so talk to me afterwards and I can point you to some ways that scales down for smaller teams. That might be an easier way to introduce that into your organization. Right? And then what I would follow with is once you see that in action from a small grassroots approach and you understand how this process was able to make resolution faster or make it a little bit better, right? Then you can start quantifying the value, selling it upwards, right? And making a case for why you need a response system like this. Anyone else? I see what you're asking. Okay, the question was, are there access controls around who can get to information about what it is that you learned from an incident? The answer to that is it's your choice, right? And how you want to do that. At PagerDuty, we tend to be pretty open about that across the company. I know that that is not always the case with some of the customers that I've interacted with. So there are ways to slice and dice that, and I would say just as you saw what our internal process was like, and then there was kind of the generic postmortem, I see that approach as well, where internally some teams may want to be a little more private about some of their learnings, but they will still share something that is more digestible by the entire organization as a way to kind of, you know, hit a compromise there. But yeah, there are different ways to slice and dice that. And with that, I think we're at time, so thank you, everyone.